Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books in Sports podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bob D'Angelo, and our guest today is Cesar Brioso, author of Last Seasons in Havana, The Castro Revolution, and The End of Professional Baseball in Cuba. Cesar, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, I'm glad to do it, Bob. Thanks.
Cesar is a digital producer and former baseball editor for USA Today Sports, and he has more than 25 years under his belt as a journalist, writing for the Miami Herald and also for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And he was also a team leader at the Tampa Tribune for several years. His first book was Havana Hardball, Spring Training, Jackie Robinson and the Cuban League, which was published in 2015. Cesar, give the listener a little bit of background about yourself, your education, and your professional career that I haven't mentioned.
Well, I went to the University of Florida and got a degree in journalism and started working in newspapers. My first job was at the Ocala Star-Banner, and that's kind of where this whole project with the two books that you mentioned started, because there were some of the players who had played in Cuba during the 40s and 50s were retirees in our circulation area, and I started sort of hunting them down for interviews for the paper, with eventually the idea of hoping to write a book about baseball in Cuba.
And of course you write a blog about Cuban baseball right now too.
Yeah, in fact, the blog is really what got me the first book. I'd been kind of gathering interviews and doing research, but didn't really have an entree into the publishing business. Mm-hmm. And wasn't sure how to get a book published. And at some point, I guess about 2005, I just kind of decided, you know what, I'm going to blog about Cuban baseball history. I don't care if anybody else reads it except me, but it was sort of going to be my outlet for all this material that I'd gathered. And fortunately, one day I got an email from a former journalism professor. He's a published author, and he asked me if I had a publisher for all the material I was putting together. And I said, no, I don't. Why? You know someone? And he said he might. So he put me in touch with the University Press of Florida, and that's how the first book, Havana Hardball, came to be.
Right. So certainly this new book, I mean, is at least partially a project that's extremely personal for you. You were born in Havana and you had family members who were impacted by Castro's takeover. What stories do you remember your family talking about as far as Cuba and baseball in Cuba? I mean, it could be political, it could be baseball as well.
Well, my interest in this really started because of my dad. When I was a kid, he would tell me about all these American players who would come to Cuba in the winter and play in the Cuban League. People like Tom Lasorda and Monty Irvin, Ray Dandridge, Max Lanier. My dad would tell me these stories. And, as a kid, I listened, but I was more interested in the games that were happening in the present time. But as I grew older and I grew to appreciate the history of baseball, I started to realize some of the players he was telling me about were Hall of Famers and that sort of thing. I became more and more interested. And then finally, when I became a sports writer, it was just the natural thing that I wanted to kind of find these guys and talk to them about their experiences in Cuba.
And your first book, you know, focuses on one season, which was the monumental season when Jackie Robinson made his debut in spring of 1947. What made you decide to focus on the final years of the 1950s?
Well, this book, Last Seasons in Havana, really just is kind of picks up where the first book left off. You know, in the first book, as you know, it was the sort of what maybe the best season in Cuban League history, or at least the finale was this epic three-game series between Havana and Almendares, the eternal rivals of the Cuban League. And as they were finishing that, Jackie Robinson, the Dodgers, and the Montreal Royals arrived in Havana for spring training in 1947. And also sort of, this was also happening at the same time that the Mexican League was raiding players from the majors, and that impacted the Cuban League that year. So what ends up happening at the end of Havana Hardball, the Cuban League has a truce with the organized baseball and comes under the umbrella of organized baseball. So this book, the new one, is really sort of what happens to the Cuban League after that. The truce with organized baseball sort of sets forth the rules by which the Cuban League can sign players from the majors and the minors. Before it had been the Cuban League had a certain amount of autonomy. The managers and owners basically used their connections in the Negro Leagues and in the majors from having played there to sort of sign players and recruit players as they saw fit. Now with them being under the umbrella of organized baseball, it sort of codified how they would get players. And, the Cuban League does very well into the 50s, but then things start to change, not just for baseball, but for the country. When Castro arrives in the mountains in the eastern province of Oriente and starts a guerrilla war against Batista, the dictator of Cuba at the time.
Right. And I guess to that point, I mean, Cuban baseball was fairly healthy. And when they got the franchise in the International League, it was like, I think in your book, you said they're like one step away from, you know, getting a major league franchise. And I'm sure that was a dream of a lot of, you know, baseball fans in Cuba.
Yeah, well, it was an explicit dream of Bobby Maduro. He built the El Gran Stadium of Havana in 1946 for the Cuban League, eventually bought the Class B Havana Cubans of the Florida International League, and then moved that team to AAA as the Havana Sugar Kings. That was in 1954. The AAA team in Cuba started right before Castro's revolution really started to pick up. And the motto of the Sugar Kings was in Spanish, "Un paso más y llegamos," one more step and we get there. And that wasn't just an allusion to the players in AAA being one step from the majors. It was also Bobby Maduro's goal to bring an expansion team to Havana at some point.
You know, many readers, including myself, I mean, they always had this view of pre-Castro Cuba. You know, we get it all from Godfather Part Two, you know, with Hyman Roth sitting on the hotel and saying, you know, we got great partnership with the government and whatever. But really, what was the real Cuba like during that final decade of the 50s when Batista was in power?
Yeah, I mean, that's the mob that you sort of see depicted in The Godfather is obviously Hollywoodized, the Hollywood version of it, but they were there. Meyer Lansky and Santo Traficante, they were there. They either owned or had control or had partial control of several different casinos, and they operated in plain sight. I mean, remember, you know, gambling and casinos was legal, so that it wasn't like they were, at least as far as that, doing anything that was against the law. So it was, I guess, you know, you could say this was their legitimate business in a way. And they certainly had their, they probably did have their influence. It probably was not as great as some books and movies portray it. But they operated there and I think operated sort of legitimately, if you can say that.
you know, in your book, I mean, you hooked me right at the beginning there where you start with the first anecdote where you're talking about soldiers sitting in the stands during opening night for the Sugar Kings waiting to see if the coup against Batista was going to come off. What year was that, by the way? I meant to ask.
Well, that's what I couldn't pin down specifically. I knew it was, and it wasn't soldiers. These were just sort of, these were regular people. But they were against the Batista regime. And they sort of were, you know, it was, I know it happened in the inaugural game, and I know it happened before the, there was an attack on the presidential palace in March of 1957. So that would mean that it either happened in, 54, 55, or 56. And the story you're talking about is actually my uncle. He was one of those conspirators. And they were, sitting in the top rows of the stand waiting for a signal to tell them that another group had successfully attacked Batista's motorcade, and they were going to go storm a police substation and basically start the overthrow of Batista. The idea was to put Carlos Prio Socarrás back in power. He had been the elected president of Cuba, who Batista had overthrown in 1952. But the signal never came, and the game ended. And they just, what ended up happening was that the motorcade had taken a different route, and so they sort of scattered and ditched whatever arms they may have had in case they were found out.
And to sidetrack to your uncle too, I mean, you note in your introduction of the preface where, you know, he was anti-Batista, but he sort of ran afoul of Castro early on in his regime. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, he was in the so the bus drivers union, and right after the revolution, the Castro regime started putting its own people in key places and kind of rounded up everybody that was in that union. And he got caught up in that and ended up about a month and a half at La Cabaña Fortress, and was very fortunate to be let out. That somebody spoke on his behalf, basically to let them know that he wasn't a Batista supporter before the revolution, and he was able to get out, but a very scary time for him.
Oh, no doubt. And I know you also wrote that your family was sort of split as far as, Castro and anti-Castro.
Yeah. My grandfather was one of 11 siblings, and four or five of them, sympathized with the Castro revolution and became communists. And that led to a lot of family arguments. And if those that didn't support the revolution were essentially ostracized from the rest of the family, sometimes never to speak again. In fact, one, I guess it would be, one of the sons of my grandfather's brothers lived in Tampa, and I tried to reach out to him when we were down there, and I just and never responded.
Feelings run deep.
Yeah.
What I also found interesting in the book was the influx of American baseball players who competed in the winter season in Cuba. I mean, guys like Tommy Lasorda and others. And what was the attraction for these guys to come off to the Cuban leagues or the winter leagues after a major league season? Although some of them were in the minors, maybe they were trying to get to the majors, but what was the attraction for them?
Well, you know, this is a time before all the big contracts that we see today. So for a lot of these players, if you weren't a star, when the season ended, you had to kind of go get a real job for the off season, work at a hardware store in your hometown or wherever. So if you had the choice of getting a real job or going to play baseball in the tropics, you know, that seems like a pretty easy choice. They were well paid. They were taken care of in Cuba. They'd be set up with a nice place to stay. The Cuban Winter League might have only played, maybe four games a week. So there was downtime that they could enjoy, whether it be the beaches, the casinos, the horse track. So it was kind of a working vacation as well as, staying in shape, getting paid a decent amount. Having a lot of times they would bring their families down there with them, their wives and kids. It was kind of a working vacation.
And well, I mean, obviously as the decade got later and then Castro became more prominent, they had to be kind of a little bit leery about what was going on there.
Sure. There was, after Castro took over, there started to be these counter-revolutionary moves. The previous leaders, some of them in exile in the United States, were funding anti-Castro revolution themselves. It started to become obvious that things were drifting toward communism. He began expropriating lands, and then as tensions and relations deteriorated with the U.S., they started getting closer to the Soviet Union. So there were concerns about what might happen. For the Sugar Kings, the International League started coming up with contingency plans in case they needed to relocate the franchise. Sometimes major league teams did not want or wondered if they should have their players playing in the Cuban League. But for the most part, the players were safe. There was one incident in the book. I describe it. This was in a Sugar Kings game in 1959. It was the anniversary of the 26th of July movement, Castro's revolution. And when this was a game between the Sugar Kings and the Red Wings, and when Rochester Red Wings, and when the clock struck 12, soldiers outside the stadium started firing off guns, and apparently some stray bullets hit guys inside the stadium. Leo Cardenas, shortstop for the Sugar Kings, and Frank Verdi, who was coaching third base at the time, both got struck. The game was stopped, and the Red Wings refused to finish the series the next day and left town. But even with that, the team stayed in Havana, and the season continued.
Yeah, and the thing with Castro, going back to his movement and everything, he insisted for the longest time that he wasn't a communist.
Yeah, even though he had, his brother was, Raul was, and he had Che Guevara, who was definitely a communist. Some have tried to say that he might have just sort of stumbled or kind of worked his way toward communism. But I've seen, Castro biographers who said that he basically had almost a shadow government. He continued the even though there was a president that he installed, he had the position of prime minister, and this group that included his brother Che Guevara and others, Camilo Cienfuegos, that they were basically intent on making Cuba a Marxist-Leninist.
Right, we'll talk about Camilo Pascual now. Another thing I found interesting in the book was the backstory for some of these players, like Pascual and Orlando Pena. I mean, I remember Pascual pitching in the 60s, and he probably had one of the best curveballs that anybody's ever seen. And I always wondered, especially because his record in the majors was kind of, around 500. I just wondered if he overworked himself pitching in the majors and in the winter leagues. I mean, he was quite a pitcher in the winter leagues.
Yeah, well, and he was a terrific pitcher. Everybody talked about that curveball that you mentioned, but he did have some arm trouble. Was that because of pitching in the winter in Cuba, or did he just hurt it? Did he just hurt it, and it just impacted his effectiveness? I guess there was a couple of seasons where he didn't play, at the insistence of the team trying to protect him. He was a heck of a pitcher, and probably his record doesn't really show how good he was.
Yeah, and I think Pena is another example. I remember looking at his baseball cards in the 60s, and I was like, yeah, whatever, But he was dynamite in Cuba.
Yeah.
Is it just a...
I mean, the Cuban League was probably, how I've heard it described to me, was somewhere between AAA and the majors. In terms of the quality of play, you didn't have maybe the top echelon major leaguers playing, or at least what you had were guys who were on their way up who would become good players, like Brooks Robinson played a season there, for example, Don Newcomb, just kind of Joe Black, Hoyt Wilhelm. You know, so they had players who went on to great careers, but in a lot of cases, you were catching them early in their career. There, once they had the agreement with organized baseball, you know, they had to be of a certain experience level. If it went beyond that, they couldn't play in the Cuban league. Cuban born players, of course, were exempt from those restrictions. You know, you weren't getting necessarily guys who were, you know, it had been in the majors for five, six years, and were really starting to establish themselves, but you were getting the guys as they were coming up. It would be like if you were a fan here at a, you know, what, and you would be going to AAA games, you'd see the guys who would become stars, you know, in the future, but you were getting them at while they were still developing.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, I also found it interesting. I mean, I wondered why the Washington Senators were such a beneficiary of Cuban talent, because Clark Griffith and then Calvin Griffith were not exactly progressive guys in terms of race and ethnicity. I mean, how did the Senators benefit so well from all these guys?
Well, because they had scout Joe Cambria, who pretty much lived down there, Papa Joe, and he signed like 300 to 400 Cuban players, and he signed them on the cheap. So he was just signing up any players he could, and with that sort of stockpile, you know, some of those guys went on to make it, you know, to play for the Senators. But that was basically it. I think it was, you know, Cuba was a source of cheap talent for the Senators.
Oh, and the Griffiths were big on being cheap. So, yeah. Talk about Bobby Maduro again. What kind of impact did he have on baseball in Cuba?
Well, I mean, he's beloved by people who played for him and worked with him and knew him. You know, like I said, he built the stadium, which still exists. It's Estadio Latinoamericano, which is where the Rays played the Cuban National League team in that spring training game a few years ago.
Yeah, 2015.
So that still exists. That's the ballpark where the Cuban League, the four teams, they all played in that same stadium. You know, so there wasn't travel. They didn't have to go to the other cities, even though the teams had names for other parts of the country. All of them played right there in Havana. You know, I kind of described it in the first book, like if you want to look at the New York of the 50s with the Yankees, Giants, and Dodgers, throw in the Mets and have them play at a brand new Yankee stadium. You know, that was kind of what you were dealing with down there. And, you know, that was because he built that stadium. Before, they had been in the league had been in a stadium that was a little further outside. It wasn't a baseball only stadium. It was, you know, it could accommodate soccer and track and field. And this was a baseball only stadium. And that was Maduro's doing, you know, and then of course the whole, you know, pushing to get the Class B team into AAA, pushing to, you know, potentially, hopefully get a major league team in Havana. So he was, you know, he owned one of the Cuban league teams. He was had a huge impact on baseball in Cuba in the 40s and 50s.
And he really had to be devastated when he had to give up the team and then it went and moved to Jersey City. I know he came back in some capacity, but that just had to be like just shattering.
Well, yeah, I mean, he ended up losing everything. The team was moved while they were on the road. just tensions and had just gotten to the point where the International League president, Frank Shaughnessy, just said, "But they're moving." He was not happy about it. The manager of the team ended up coming back, but most of the players ended up staying when they moved to Jersey City in the middle of the 1960 season. And Maduro was eventually able to get out of Cuba. His family had come over first. And then he sort of rejoined the Jersey City Jerseys. That's what they were called in 1961. And then eventually he and the team moved to Jacksonville as the Jacksonville Suns. And then eventually he a couple of years later, he ended up selling the team. But he worked in the commissioner's office for baseball. The Miami Stadium, which had been the home of the minor league Miami Marlins back in the day, and also the Orioles spring training home was renamed for him. He was a huge figure in Cuban baseball.
I also like in the book how you address the legend, this legend that's been going on for years about Fidel Castro having some sort of talent as a pitcher, and how the whole Cuban Revolution might have never happened if some team had signed Fidel to a minor league deal.
It really is the stuff of urban legend. The first reference I could find to any sort of discussion of what Fidel Castro's baseball talent was Joe Cambria, kind of an offhand remark that he saw him, watched him pitch at one point, and that he thought he was basically not much more than a minor leaguer. Fidel was an athlete. He had played like basketball and volleyball in college. And as Ralph Avila, who used to be the Dodgers Latin American scouting director for years, he said, like all Cubans, he played baseball, pickup games. But in terms of actually being a prospect, that just really was never the case. But every time the story was retold, it just seemed to grow and grow and grow. To the point where in one magazine article, a player who had played in the Cuban League, recounted this story of Castro climbing out of the stands and taking over the mound and pitching to him. But all the details, including what team he was on and who he played for, were just did not fit the facts. So it just never happened. But it's kind of amazing how that
grows every year. During his lifetime, and gosh.
Yeah, and I'm sure he was glad to let it continue to grow.
Oh, definitely so.
Yeah, but yeah, that was totally an urban legend.
Also, one of all the people you interviewed, you came across a guy that was a bat boy for Jersey City the first year they're up there, Al Lopez Chavez. Talk about how you connected with him.
Yeah, that was great. I was doing a book signing in Miami for the first book, and this gentleman comes up and he has his phone with him, and he shows me his phone, and it's a photo of him as a little boy in an Almendares, one of the teams in Cuba, wearing an Almendares uniform, and he's on the field with Roberto Ortiz, who played with the Senators at one point. He was a big star in the Cuban League, and he's like, that's me. He started talking, and that's when he said that he said he was a bad boy for the Sugar Kings. And I'm like, well, I need to talk to you. So I got his information. I called him. And that's when he told me about the fact that, it wasn't really the Sugar Kings. The Sugar Kings had moved to Jersey City, and in in 1961, he did a composition, contest to be one of the bad boys, and he ended up winning. So he was the bat boy for the Jersey City Jerseys in 1961. Then he was from Cuba. His family had moved to Jersey City before the revolution, I think in 1957. He's a huge baseball fan, Almendares fan, and they were actually able to listen to some games in New Jersey. So then one day he gets home from school, and his dad says, "Hey, they're looking for a bat boy." And so he went ahead and entered the contest and was one of the two boys that won. He ended up being with the Jersey's bat boy in the the boy who finished second was the bat boy for the visiting teams.
Now, talking about your research for this, I mean, what did you learn from your research about baseball in Cuba that was particularly helpful? I mean, did you go through some of the old newspaper clippings in Havana? And I'm sure you did the sporting news because they were very detailed as far as the Cuban league goes.
Yeah, that was the great thing. The sporting news really was the baseball Bible. And they covered not just the Cuban league, but all the Latin leagues every week. With stories dedicated to each league, usually a feature story, and then like a quick recount of all the week's games. So they were very detailed in terms of covering the Cuban league, and being a member of Sabre, the Society for American Baseball Research, I was able to you have access to this database, searchable database of all the sporting news. So that was really helpful. The University of Miami has a Diario La Marina, which was a paper in Havana, one of the papers in Havana. They have that available on the web as well. And also, the New York Times, in terms of the coverage of what was going on politically, the revolution, they had a writer based in Havana throughout the 50s. So I was able to, read all these, accounts of the day from newspapers and the sporting news, which was a huge help. And then, of course, the interviews I was able to do with the players I was able to find that were still around.
Right. I think you did 20 or 21 players. And I think you talked about the one you did with Orlando Pena, which was more or less, I think you said it was more like a monologue from him as opposed to you asking a lot of questions.
Yeah, it was terrific. He works at the radio station in Miami. I'd been trying to reach him forever, and he didn't know me. So never responded to my messages, but I called one of the guys working at the station and he, got him on the phone for me. I made my pitch and he said, come by the station next time you're in town and we'll talk. And it was terrific. He held court, and told all these amazing stories. It was a terrific interview.
And then he put you on the radio.
Yeah, I was not expecting that. I figured, okay, interview's over. I'll go home. I'll have dinner. And then they were like, him and the guy who is the host of the show, like, well, you should come on. And I'm like, okay. I called my wife and we were visiting my family at the time, called my parents, said, yeah, I'm not going to make it for dinner because this happened. And they were like, yeah, forget dinner. Get on the radio. It was fun. So that was my first Spanish language appearance on
and I radio. Guess you held up pretty well.
I survived.
Now, in this second book, from start to finish, how long did it take you to complete the project? When did you start it?
Well, I started it as I was promoting the first book. I pretty much knew, I would always be asked, like, what's going to be the next book? And I just kind of knew, well, it's going to be about this particular time period. So I started gathering articles and making phone calls, trying to reach some of these players. So I, the book came out in 2015. So probably, 2016, while I was out trying to promote it, I was already doing interviews and gathering articles and whatever information I could. In terms of the writing, itself, I was able to write it in a year, pretty much a chapter a month, and that's kind of the pace I hoped to do, set for myself, and I was able to do that.
Now, in your research, what did you learn that really surprised you the most when you looked at it and went, "Wow, I didn't know that"?
Oh gosh, having researched it for so long, I knew a lot of the. I knew a lot of it, right? Certainly the broad strokes, as I was writing, I would realize that I needed to drill down, on specific things, or I didn't have all the information about a given game or a given event. The hardest thing for me really was, getting myself up to speed on what was going on with the political upheaval, with the revolution, and then trying to sort of synthesize that. I wanted to give enough of that part of the story so that people would understand what was going on, the context that this baseball story is told in, but without, you know, going so far in the weeds that you lose sight of the baseball stuff. So, you know, that was the hardest thing for me in terms of learning something. I'll tell you the sort of shocking thing, surprising thing, I actually learned in the first book, and I wrote about it when the Dodgers were in spring training in Cuba, to find out that Dixie Walker had basically invented those base protect the fencing that they use during infield.
Oh, right. Because the coach got hit with a ball or something.
Yeah, and you know that Dixie Walker, he owned a sporting goods store back in Birmingham, Alabama, with his family, and a guy got hit during BP during infield, and so he sort of fashioned this, this fencing, you know, to protect the guys at first, second, and third during BP, so they wouldn't get hit while they were doing infield. You know, something that you now see like everywhere, right? You see, you know, but the fact
you
that
take
that,
it for granted.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But the fact that this was created in Cuba in spring training by this guy from the Dodgers, I just thought, you know, this is a very inside baseball thing, but I just loved that. I just thought that was really, really cool.
Oh, yeah. Did you find it more challenging to write the second book?
Like I said, because of the, because it wasn't just about baseball, you know, because I had to, you know, learn and write about all the specifics about the revolution and what was going on politically. That part of it absolutely was more challenging and trying to mix that in. But I, having gone through the experience of the first book, I did find that I wrote more efficiently, if that makes sense, this time around. Maybe I was more disciplined, you know, the first one took like about a year and a half or so, and there were months where I didn't write a single chapter. I just did I researched or did something else. I definitely was more efficient just having gone through the process. Trying to become a, you know, political scientist, you know, while I was doing this was the challenging part.
Definitely. Well, I mean, you're efficient in your writing, but this, I noticed in this book, you just had your style seemed a lot more comfortable in the first one. You know, maybe the first book you're getting your feet wet, but this book was much more relaxed in tone and much more comfortable to me. I mean, I got the sense that you relaxed more.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. You know, you just never know how a book's going to be received. So, you know, you do your best and you hope people like it. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, here's the part of the interview where I ask you, you know, what have I missed as an interview? What is there anything you'd like to add about this book that hasn't been mentioned? I mean, what should people take from this book?
Well, I guess.
Or have I been so thorough that we can't answer
well,
that?
No, I think just the baseball in Cuba and the connection between baseball in Cuba and baseball in the U.S., just how deep it ran, you know, going back really to the, you know, late 1890s, you know, the first barnstorming team with John McGraw, you know, coming through there. And then, you know, all the Negro League teams that barnstormed in Cuba, Negro League players who played in the Cuban League, all the Americans that came to Cuba, but then also all the Cuban players that came to the Negro Leagues and the majors, just that connection, that free flow of talent for decades. You know, just that, you know, we, you know, you see a hint of that only today because of the guys who have defected. But, you know, before 1959, before 1961, which is when the Cuban League folded, you know, that was just common. That's what happened. You know, guys played in Cuba, and Cuban players came here, and we lost that for decades because of the revolution. There were all these players that probably, you know, could have been just as good as you know, the Tony Perez's and the Tony Olivas of the world that we saw here, but that American fans just never got the chance to see. You know, now we you know, Major League Baseball has come up with this agreement now with Cuba. We'll see what happens there, but you know, it appears that as long as the Trump administration doesn't nix it, it looks like there's now an opening to get for those players to get a chance to come here and play, and for fans to see more players. I think like the you know Jose Abreu and Cespedes and Puig, and just see the talent that's always been there.
Yeah, that's just a taste. I mean, it's been 60 years since they had the open pipeline, but yeah, you're right. Those guys have been outstanding, and there's probably some guys playing in Cuba right now that could come over and step right into the majors.
It's possible, yeah. Hopefully we'll find out.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
And you know, if you have this exchange, you know, maybe that will help facilitate some kind of change back in Cuba. Mm-hmm.
So do you look at this as a sports book or a history book or a combination of both?
It's a combination of both. I mean, what I say is, you know, it's a baseball story told within the context of the political upheaval in Cuba at the time, because I think you needed to tell both stories in order to really get the full picture, because one impacted the other. But it is at its heart a baseball story. It's just told within the context of what was going on politically in Cuba.
This has been very interesting for me. I enjoyed this type of interview, and I know your time is valuable to it, but tell me, do you have another project in the works?
I've been thinking about it. Like, do I want to do another baseball book? And what I think I've landed on is I want to tell the story of my family in Cuba. I included some of that in this book, with the opening story, and then just sort of in the introduction, and at the end, you got some sense of what my family went through. I know I have a lot of amazing stories from them. What I have to try to figure out is, do I have enough that I can weave it together in a narrative worthy of a book? So I think, unlike the first two books where I accepted I put out a proposal, it was accepted, and I knew I could get to the end point. This one, I think I want to write completely and make sure that I do it justice before I even submit it to publishers. But I think that's where I want to go next.
Well, we've been speaking with Cesar Brioso, author of Last Seasons in Havana, The Castro Revolution, and The End of Professional Baseball in Cuba. Thank you, Cesar, for being on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it, too.
You've been listening to New Books in Sports, the channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bob D'Angelo, and thank you again for listening. Until next time, remember that the game is what matters.